Hello, this is your Sun Sounds volunteer reader, Priscilla Corja in Flagstaff with Northland Views. Today is April 16th, 2025. I'll be reading from Camp Verde Community Library Host Egg Hatchalong by Julio Mora Rodriguez, April 8th, 2025. On Wednesday, March 26th, Camp Verde Community Library staff marked the arrival of spring on March 20th by placing 14 eggs in an incubator on display in the library for their first ever Hatchalong event. The incubator is visible to anyone who walks into the library, and patrons can watch the growth of the chickens inside the egg until they hatch. Visitors can also suggest names for the chickens via a comment box. The eggs are expected to hatch on or around April 16th after 21 days in the incubator. They were provided by library clerk Julianne Adolph, who planned to hatch them at Horn, but brought them to the library after one of her coworkers suggested they make it a community event. Adolph said that she hoped the hatch-along would give children and adults a better understanding of where their food comes from, noting that chicken keeping is quite common in Camp Verde and the surrounding area. "It's actually been years and years since I hatched anything, so this has been exciting that I found a supplier for these eggs and was able to get them in," Adolph said. Adolph provided eggs from a breed known as the Swedish flower hen or Skunks Blomhemel, one of the 11 traditional chicken breeds of Sweden, a land race that almost went extinct in the 1970s but has since been brought back. The Swedish flower hen has somewhat resembles a cross between a Rhode Island Red and a barred rock in appearance, and with a lifespan of around a decade, lives longer than a number of other breeds. Adolph commented that they were also able to bred to be more predator aware than any other breeds of chicken. "I'm hoping to add that help them protect the rest of from the flock. We do have a lot of predator pressure here in the form of coyotes, raccoons, skunks, hawks, and wild dogs," Adolph said. Adolph plans to use the chickens as egg layers after they hatch, while the eggs that don't hatch will be composted. And that is the end of the article. Files for writ asking court to compel PNZ to revoke slag permit by Christopher Fox Graham, posted on April 10th, 2025. Cottonwood resident Jennifer Richards filed a legal action in Yavapai County Superior Court, known as a petition of writ of mandamus, against the individual members of the Cottonwood Planning and Zoning Commission: Lindsay Maston, Randy Garrison, Daniel Cornella, James Glasscott, George Griller, and Bob Rothrock, and Cottonwood Development's Director Scott Ellis, on February 5th, asking the court to compel them to vote to revoke Minerals Research Incorporation's conditional use permit related to the slag pile in Cottonwood. A writ of mandamus is a court order directing a government official to fulfill their official duties properly or correct an abuse of discretion. Acting as the city attorney, John A. Gaylord of Gus Rosenfield PLC filed a motion to dismiss the petition on February 25th for failure to state a claim, failure to provide a notice of claim, and failure to set forth a non-discretionary duty of the commission, which is a deliberative legislative body that a court can compel. Mandamus is an extraordinary remedy issued by court to compel a public officer to perform an act which the law specifically imposes as a duty, Gaylord wrote. Gaylord first asserted that Richard's petition had failed to meet basic legal standards. Mere conclusory statements are insufficient to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. A complaint that states only legal conclusions without any supporting factual allegations does not satisfy Arizona's notice pleading standard. To satisfy Arizona's mandatory notice of claim statute, a plaintiff must file a notice of claim against the public entity and each public employee in court, but Richard skipped that necessary state. Under state law, a public entity cannot be sued unless a plaintiff properly files a notice of claim. A notice of claim is not required for writs because they do not seek any financial damages, Richards, who is acting as her own attorney, said on March 14th. The issue he is trying to bring up is that historically you had to file a verified complaint with the petition for writ, but that just changed last month, where now you can file the writ with no complaint, but the courts would not accept just the petition for writ, so I had to file the complaint as well. Plaintiff's failure to comply with the notice of claim requirement necessitates dismissal of the complaint as anything other than a vehicle for her petition for mandamus, Gaylord asserts. In light of the recent rule change, Gaylord asked the court to rule on whether Richards intended her complaint as a vehicle for petition for mandamus, or if the complaint stands apart from her petition for writ. I filed both an amended complaint and a response to the motion to dismiss, but apparently I only needed to file the amended complaint as it counts as a response, so the defense asked me to choose which one to proceed with, and I chose the amended complaint, Richards said. Richards filed her amended complaint on February 27th. Second, Richards failed to state a claim for which the court could grant relief, Gaylord wrote. Her factual allegations do not amount to a cause of action, Gaylord asserts. Her recitation leads to her ultimate request for mandamus, and the city therefore presumes that the mandamus is the only relief sought. In short, plaintiff falls short of the Rule 8 pleading requirements and has failed to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, even taking her allegations as true. Accordingly, the city respectfully requests the dismissal of the complaint as anything other than a vehicle for mandamus. A writ of mandamus is not a typical civil lawsuit, but rather an extraordinary judicial remedy, Richards says. At least that is what I have found in my research. I am representing myself, and the attorney for the city in our required pre-trial conference agreed that notice of claim is not necessary for the writ. But he, Gaylord, is trying to argue that the portion is a complaint which would have needed it if I am asking for damages, which I am not. Third, mandamus cannot command non-discretionary acts such as the personal decisions made by members of a legislative body, which, in the opinion of the members of the body, are in the best interest in the citizens of the public entity, Gaylord wrote. The commission does not have any general duty to hold public hearings, to hold a public hearing whenever one is requested, or to hold a public hearing upon the receipt of a complaint, Gaylord further asserts. Rather, a public hearing is held when, in the opinion of the commission, a hearing is in the both best interests of the citizens of the city and necessary. Plaintiff cites to the above subsections A, B, and E, which are each controlled by the opening line, which states that the commission may. This is an expressly discretionary matter, and therefore not subject to mandamus, Gaylord wrote. Regarding Ellis and his role as a city employee, plaintiff cites that the language in the job description of a community development director, a human resources job description, is not a law, and it does not create a legal duty that can be compelled by mandamus, Gaylord wrote. Further, the language that she has cited is descriptive, which means it does not even purport to establish a duty. The language also does not say anything about setting public hearings or revoking CUPs. Plaintiff's citation to the word coordinate, which the job description simply does not support the argument she is making. Defendants respectfully request the dismissal of the complaint and the petition for a writ of mandamus, Gaylord concluded. Plaintiff's complaint fails to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, and plaintiff did not file the requisite notice of claim. Further, the petition does not identify any mandatory duty of the commission to hold a public hearing on any alleged violations of the CUP. The holding of a hearing in these circumstances is an explicitly discretionary duty. Accordingly, mandamus cannot be granted. The complaint and petition, and therefore this original special action, should be dismissed with prejudice. And that is the end of the article. Sedona Torch Run on April 11th supports Special Olympics by Joseph K. Giddens, April 10th, 2025. The public is encouraged to cheer on the runners for the Sedona Police Department's 2025 Law Enforcement Torch Run in support of Special Olympics Arizona, which will take place on Friday, April 11th, starting at 9 a.m. at the Sedona Cultural Park. Participants will walk, run, and wheel along the sidewalk down State Route 89A East to the finish area at the intersection of State Route 89A and Northview Road, located at 1771 West State Route 898. No roads will be closed during the event, and drivers will be alerted by electronic signs along the route. The event is organized by the SPD Officer Catherine Beers is in the tradition of the original Torch Run, which involved law enforcement agencies nationwide. The Law Enforcement Torch Run began in 1981 in Wichita, Kansas, when Chief Richard Lemunyan created a way for law enforcement to support the Special Olympics in a meaningful way, Beers wrote in a press release. It has since grown into the largest grassroots fundraiser and public awareness campaign for Special Olympics globally, with officers from around the world carrying the flame of hope to the opening ceremonies of Special Olympics competitions. The traditional version of the law enforcement torch run, which involved agency-to-agency handoffs, was abandoned as part of the COVID-19 pandemic response, and the current format of having athletes and officers run with the torch was Beer's invention. "It's high energy for the athletes," Beer said. When the old event took place, it was literally just the law enforcement officers that would run the torch from county to county and hand it to the next agency, so the athletes weren't a participant, they were the recipient of the funds that are raised for the law enforcement torch run. So it's become a favorite of theirs because the focus is on them. Beer said that additional volunteers for the events are not needed, and that the community can support the event by cheering the participants on or honking their horns while passing. "If there's anybody that you know who is willing to stand along the course, it's exciting for the athletes," Beer said. Last year, the employees from the Marriott had a dozen people out there with noisemakers near the start of the route. "That was unexpected, and I remember it was emotional for the athletes to get that send-off." In addition to officers and volunteers from SPD, the Cottonwood, Fort McDowell, Oro Valley, Payson, Prescott, and Prescott Valley police departments will be participating along with the Coconino County Sheriff's Office, the Yavapai County Sheriff's Office, the Sedona Fire District, and the Northern Arizona Regional Training Academy. A special guest for this year's run will be Sedona resident Joanne King, a 61-year-old Special Olympics athlete who competed in the Special Olympics for 35 years starting at age 5. King was a multi-medal winner in a number of swimming events, including freestyle, butterfly, backstroke, and diving, but also competed in a cross-country skiing and bowling. "We just had this huge box of medals, and she was always up there as the gold medal winner," said her sister and guardian Kathleen King, estimating her medal count at over 200. "She was an athlete right out the gate. When she was born running." Joanne King said that competing in Special Olympics made her stronger both physically and mentally throughout the constant training and community. "It's competitive, but it's also collaborative," Kathleen said, "because one thing about special needs and the Special Olympics is that they want each other to do well. That's one of the strongest things that affect Joanne's life and our lives, too." During the closing ceremony for the torch run, athletes who are graduating from the Sedona Red Rock High School Red Rocker team will conclude the run by breaking the banner at the finish line. The program is expected to conclude by 11:30 a.m. Athlete Aldo Lara Ayala will be graduating this year, SOCSD special education teacher Tiffany Wilson said about this year's honoree. "He has been with our Unified Special Olympics team, Sedona Red Rockers, since our team started spring of 2018. He has competed in bocce, bowling, and track and field over the years and received numerous gold medals amongst the medals he has won at local and state competitions. He enjoys training and competing, making lasting friendships with previous members of our team. In his time on our United Special Olympics team, Aldo has been spoken in front of audiences numerous times, fundraising and teaching others about the programs." Beer said that the SPD and the Sedona Oak Creek School District joint Minute That Matters fundraiser that had students collect change at both campuses during the second week of March raised over $1,000 to support the Unified Special Olympics teams in the district. Residents will be able to support Special Olympics Arizona again in the fall during the second annual SPD's Golf Scramble at the Oak Creek Country Club on Saturday, October 11th. For more information, visit tiny.url. Beers also accepts donations year-round for Special Olympics Arizona. To learn more or get involved, contact her at cbeers@sedonaaz.gov. And that is the end of the article. You're tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you're listening to Northland Views. Officers serve Cottonwood Oak Creek School District by Julio Mora Rodriguez, April 11, 2025. All four kindergarten to eighth grade schools in the Cottonwood Oak Creek School District now have at least one school resource officers at school safety officers since the program that was started 3 years ago. The newest additions in this year were Cottonwood Community School and Oak Creek School in Cornville. COCSD Superintendent Jessica Volka said that Dr. Daniel Bright and Mountain View Preparatory have school resource officers, while CCS and OCS have school safety officers. The difference being that SROs are permanently assigned to a school campus, while SSOs are off-duty police or YCSO deputies assigned to a school for a day or a non-permanent basis. Dr. Daniel Bright and Oak Creek School are outside Cottonwood city limits and covered by the Yavapai County Sheriff's Office, while Mountain View Preparatory and Cottonwood Community School officers come from the ranks of the Cottonwood Police Department. Dr. Daniel Bright's SRO is a YCSO deputy, Alex Hawkins, who has been at the school for the last 3 years. Voca says he has a good relationships with faculty and students. Mountain View's Prep's SRO is Roger Scareem, a former Cottonwood police officer who worked in for the department for 24 years before retiring in May 2023. It's amazing we're able to have officers there daily just to mitigate any issues from anything that happens, Voca said. It does bring a grounded sense to each campus as far as that, if anything were to happen. Unfortunately, things happen every day all over the place. If anything were to happen, they have a first responder right there on campus right away. The program is funded by the Arizona Department of Education. Voca said that the structure of the grant program determined which schools had SSOs versus SROs, as the districts had the option to use certain grants flexibly to cover multiple positions. Voca said that the officers act as advocates for the children whenever they are discussing problems that arise between students, with faculty, and parents, and that she felt the relationships officers built with the communities were very positive. And that is the end of the article. Steve King and Yavapai County Lobby for Federal SRS Funds by Joseph K. Giddens, published on April 12, 2025. Yavapai County School Superintendent Steve King addressed a meeting of the Kiwanis Club of Sedona Bell Rock on Tuesday, April 1st. His first speech to the group followed his victory in an uncontested general election last year. King said that he had met with a staffer from U.S. Representative Eli Crane's office the previous day to lobby for the reauthorization of the Secure Rural Schools program, which provides about $1.5 million in federal funding for Yavapai County schools each year. The program was last authorized on February 15, 2021 for fiscal years 2021 to 2023. The program funds schools, roads, and services in over 700 counties by allocating U.S. Forest Service revenue from grazing leases, timber harvesting, and special use permits to these uses. Half of the funding is distributed to school districts on the basis of their enrollment numbers, while the other half is distributed by a five-member board called the Forest Fees Management Association that represents school districts and allocates its share of the funding for common projects around the country. Yavapai County Education Service Agency Executive Assistant Jen Nelson said that the county most recently received $1,485,829.93 from the program in April 2024. To date, the SRSA funds of September 2024 have not been paid out, Nelson said. Without congressional reauthorization, the program will expire at the start of the new federal fiscal year in October. Last April, the Sedona Oak Creek School District received $44,971.44 in SRSA funds, in which they paid $22,485.72 to FFMA, Nelson stated. This year, FFMA has paid $20,058.42 in elections costs for Sedona paid out to Yavapai County Elections Department, $1,434 to Coconino Elections Department, and paid out directly to SOCSD $20,610 in technology reimbursement. Yavapai County Supervisor Nikki Check, Supervisor Brooks Compton, and County Manager Maury Thompson attended the NACO Legislative Conference from March 1st through 4th in Washington, D.C., during which they also lobbied U.S. Senator Mark Kelly for the reauthorization of the SRS program and payment in lieu of taxes funding. It's a priority for our County Supervisors Association, alongside the National Association of Counties, and I'm going to be working on the Public Lands Committee within the National Association of Counties, Check subsequently said. She added that the SRS funding was closely linked to the federal payment in lieu of taxes program, which reimburses counties for property tax revenue lost to non-taxable federal lands within their boundaries. I think that just getting the word out there is very important, but I've kind of exhausted every avenue I've had, King said. It's not a new tax. It's a fee distributed out to schools because of their lack lack of taxable property, which is how many schools are funded in Arizona. It's been very successful. It's always had bipartisan support. It has never been a politically contentious issue. Crane's office did not respond to a request for comment from Larson newspapers. King also addressed his appointment of a replacement for Mingus Union High School District Governing Board President Misty L. Cox, who resigned March 25th. As county school superintendent, my responsibility is to appoint board members to open board seats, King said. And if a school board member steps down, resigns in the middle of their term, then it falls upon me to choose the next school board member. And I have my first appointment, Kayla Elder and Seligman, 2 weeks ago. And now we have a new board seat open up in Mingus. Those interested in applying for the vacancy may send a resume and a letter of interest to Jen Nelson, Yavapai County Elections Coordinator, at 2970 Center Point East, Prescott, Arizona, 86301, or by email to jen.nelson@yavapaiaz.gov. Applicants are asked to describe themselves, their education, their background, their reasons for wanting to serve on their board, their mailing and residential addresses, and their phone numbers. Letters of interest will be accepted until 5 p.m. on Wednesday, April 16th, with the appointment scheduled to be made on Friday, April 18th. King also encouraged attendees to volunteer to their local school district in any capacity. The Kiwanis Club of Sedona, Bell Rocks, meets the first Tuesday of the month at 11 a.m. at the Sedona Elks Lodge. And that is the end of the article. Rob Prost Takes Airport Rudder by Julio Mora Rodriguez, published on April 13, 2025. Rob Prost, who served as manager of the Sedona Airport from 2012 to 2015, started as manager of the Cottonwood Airport on March 3rd. "I'm happy to be here. I think this will be a positive experience," Prost said. "I saw it advertised last June. The timing just didn't work for me then. When I left the city of San Diego in 2019, my plan was that my wife and I would move back to northern Arizona. Her dad had lived in Cottonwood for years. We've been coming here for 40 plus years. I called retired Deputy City Manager Rudy Rodriguez in December last year, said, 'Are you going to re-advertise?' And they did. And I applied, and here I am." Prost is currently living in the village of Oak Creek while his wife is working on selling their home in Gig Harbor, Washington, where he was formerly manager of the Tacoma Narrows Airport. "The 2 years I was in Sedona, I had a great crew," Prost recalled. "I enjoyed being in charge of the entrepreneurial part of the business, running to the FBO, the fuel operation, and the catering. I met some great people, became a trustee in the Elks Lodge in Sedona, and I intend to rejoin that. I always thought that I should fly over here when my father-in-law lived over here," Probst said of his previous relationship to Cottonwood Airport. "But when I was still flying for the Marines, we would fly into Sedona and he would drive up and have lunch with me, and I'd fly back to El Toro in Southern California. His father-in-law used to live in the Verde Villages. He used to tell me, 'If they ever put a stoplight at State Route 260 and 89-8, I'm leaving,'" Probst said. "They did, and he died, and there was no roundabouts in Sedona or Cottonwood back in those days." Probst is taking over an airport that had recently been the target of complaints by Cottonwood and Clarkdale residents, who want the airport's operations restricted due to noise. "Airport noise is just a gift that keeps on giving. It's always there," Probst said. "This is my third week. I get emails every morning primarily about Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University and the number of planes in the traffic pattern and what time they start and what time they quit. In the 3 weeks that I've been here, Embry-Riddle has not done anything that violates the federal aviation regulations, and they know that, and the FAA knows that. My goal is to reach out to the leadership at the Embry-Riddle Flight Operations and try to develop a report and ask them to fly friendly and be better neighbors. But there is no official lever to force them to do anything different than they're doing. It would simply be an ask. Training flights. If you go on FlightAware or any of the flight tracking websites any given day, looks like maybe 4 to 8 Embry-Riddle airplanes coming and going. I was just able to get into the program that tracks the number of operations. An operation is a takeoff or landing. Looks like in February we did roughly 7,600 operations, and the majority of those are Cessna 172 aircrafts, and that's what Embry-Riddle flies, and that's what Sierra Charlie Aviation Academy down in Scottsdale fly, Probst said. Each touch and go counts as two operations, and the FAA says touch and goes are an improved aeronautical activity. FAA rules. Probe said that the city and airport's ability to limit pilot access to the airport is restricted by the Federal Aviation Administration. When you take the Airport Improvement Program grants, the airport sponsor in this city, the city of Cottonwood, literally signs a contract with the federal government that says you'll comply with the all 39 grant assurances for the period of 20 years, Probe says. If the FAA ever gave the city of Cottonwood or when Yavapai Cottonwood owned and operated the airport federal funding to acquire real property, the caveat is whatever real property was acquired with federal funding has to stay in an airport use in perpetuity. It appears that some of the ends of the runway protection zones, and object-free areas were purchased with federal money. I've been doing this for over 30 years. And there are airports that have taken the Airport Improvement Program for 30 years. The poster child is Santa Monica. The city of Santa Monica says we have no contracts with the federal government anymore, and they wanted to shut Santa Monica down, and the FAA said, no, you can't do that. I don't know of any airport that's indebted to the federal government that's been able to shut down. Arizona is a part of the reason of these rules exist. Federal law has preempted airport sponsors from controlling airspace, and what happened with the Federal Aviation Agency Act passed by Congress, which was a direct result of the two airlines that had a mid-air collision over the Grand Canyon in 1956, which essentially gave control of all the airspace and all aviation safety and safety management to the FAA, Probe said. Then in 1990, Congress passed the Airport Noise Incapacity Act, which said you can limit airport operations as long as you meet these six requirements. It talks about reasonable and not interfering with interstate commerce. No airport since 1990 has been able to meet all six requirements and impose additional restrictions. For example, Burbank Glendale Pasadena, which is the airport authority that controls the Burbank area, attempted to do that, and they petitioned to the FAA to put a curfew in at Burbank. And if any airport needed a curfew, it's Burbank. And the FAA said no. There are airports that have curfews, but they were grandfathered in because they existed prior to 1990. Noise. Some residents have asked that the city and airport require an FAA noise study of airport operations. A noise study is called a Part 150 study and is really more of a land use study that would generate noise footprints. Typically 65 decibels of community noise equivalent level, which is day-night weighted average, Probe said. From that, the FAA may fund some mitigation. For example, if you're inside the 65 community noise equivalent level decibel reading time, 12 years ago, we paved the taxi lane up there and more hangars could be built. But I drove up there last weekend before I went to church, and that taxi lane still doesn't have hangars on it, Probe said. And that is the end of your article. I'm your volunteer reader, Priscilla Corja. This was Northland Views. Join us each weekday for news around the Northland. Thanks for listening.